through construction. Learn more at davefox.com.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When a physician gives you a choice, your first impulse when it comes to your treatments is probably to ask, well, what would you do, doctor? The response depends on the science. When medical evidence is weak, physicians tend to make the patient decide, and when evidence is abundant, they make their opinions known. Dr. Dhruv Kular recently wrote about the topic for the New York Times. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Dr. Kular is a physician and researcher at Weill Cornell Medicine and director of policy dissemination at the Physicians Foundation Center for Physician Practice and Leadership. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You began your piece for the New York Times with a short blurb about you and your patient locked in a game of decision-making hot potato. Tell us, how do these types of conversations usually play out?
Well, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring attention to is when we're having these conversations with patients, often we talk about different options as certainties. And I wanted to draw attention to how much uncertainty is in each one of the decisions that we're asking patients to make and that we're making recommendations on. And so when there's a lot of uncertainty around what the right course of action is, for instance, the example that I give in the article is the one around prostate cancer. And there's a lot of controversy in the medical literature and among medical societies about whether patients should be screened for prostate cancer with a PSA. And those are the types of conversations that often we don't have great evidence one way or another. And so doctors will say, you know, it's on the patient to decide, or you tell me what you think that you want to do, given your values. And what I wanted the point I wanted to make here was maybe it should be the opposite. When the evidence is weakest, we should play the biggest role in helping our patients decide. And when the evidence is very strong, we should do more to explore their values and see, you know, even though the evidence is strong, is treatment in line with what your values are?
I think it's interesting because it sounds so logical to me that if there's weak evidence, then what in the world is a layperson going to know that you wouldn't already know in spades? And why wouldn't you help them make the decision?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it makes a lot of sense when you look at it that way. I think the way that the kind of medical establishment or a lot of doctors think about it is our job is to evaluate the evidence and make a recommendation. If the evidence isn't great or if we just don't know, either option might be okay to go with, and therefore it's okay for the patient to play a greater role or decide kind of which way to go because we don't have great evidence to steer you one way or another. Mm-hmm. But I do think you're right in the sense that, you know, one of the quotes I have in the article from Dr. Terry Fried, who's a doctor at Yale, she says, you know, when the evidence isn't good, doctors say, okay, you decide. But if we as doctors can't reason through that decision, how can we expect our patients to? It doesn't make sense.
Is there a protocol for doctors and their decision making for patients? Is there training for what doctors are supposed to do in these circumstances?
You know, the ideal scenario is one in which we kind of probe the patient's preferences, their goals, their values, and see how those things intersect with the available evidence. There's more and more training in medical school and in residencies to do that, but I think we're still a long way from where we need to be in training doctors to, number one, accept how much uncertainty exists, and number two, convey that uncertainty in a way that patients can understand.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Dhruv Kular. He's a physician and researcher at Weill Cornell Medicine and director of policy dissemination at the Physicians Foundation Center for Physician Practice and Leadership. He wrote an article for the New York Times. He wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times about this question of who decides when treatment is afoot? You know, does the doctor help you decide? Do they just give you ideas for what your choices are? Or do they, you know, and a lot of it, what Dr. Kular is saying, depends on how much they know about it. The less sure they are, the less evidence, the more risk. Doctors tend to back off more, and he thinks it should be the other way around. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. 614-292-8513. Why do you think, you mentioned something as far as doctors' comfort level with the unknown, and that's hard. They're scientists, right? They want to be sure, and if they can't be, they back fully away.
Yeah, I think, you know, people generally are very uncomfortable with uncertainty. We want to do as much as we can to reduce uncertainty and to be more sure about the decisions that we make. And I think that's particularly the case among doctors. You know, we've trained and we've studied, and one of the goals of all that education is to make confident recommendations based on what the clinical situation is and what the evidence suggests. And when we can't do that, I think it makes us very uncomfortable. And there's evidence that suggests that doctors who are more uncomfortable with uncertainty, they experience more stress at work. Mm. They're more likely to withhold information from patients. They order a lot more tests and procedures and referrals. And so it is important that just as we help patients understand how to deal with uncertainty, our medical training process is also helping doctors deal with uncertainty.
How does the language doctors use affect that conversation with patients?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, you know, the number one thing to do is acknowledge that uncertainty exists. But number two, it's important to learn how to communicate about uncertainty. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests that how we talk about, how we present different risks really affects how people understand their risks. And so one example is that people have a much easier time understanding absolute risk rather than relative risk. So an absolute risk presentation would be something like this medication reduces your risk from 10% to 5%. A relative risk presentation would be that it reduces your risk by 50%. And studies suggest that it's much easier for people to manipulate information in absolute risk when you tell them exactly where the risk is to begin with and where it's going down to, instead of what percent it's reduced by. So that's one thing that I would suggest. The second thing is that people are very sensitive to harms, and they're more sensitive to harms than they are to benefit. And so this has to do with the concept of risk aversion. People are mostly risk averse. And so while we all want to talk about the benefits of treatment, what good could come of it, we should actually do a lot more to tell people about the side effects, the potential harms, the potential complications. And we don't do enough to focus on that aspect of care.
How so? What do you mean? Like, say, I had a relative who went through some targeted radiation. They had mentioned briefly that it was a six months lapse before there'd be any side effects. I don't think they explained the side effects very well. We kind of took that at face value, but something like
right.
that, is that what you're talking about?
That is. And, you know, for instance, if we are prescribing a blood thinner would be a good example. So often we prescribe blood thinners to prevent risk of heart attack or to treat a stroke. And we talk a lot about how that blood thinner might prevent those bad things from happening. What we don't do enough talking about is bleeding risk. And so these things, obviously, when you have a blood thinner, it also increases your risk for bleeding. So that's another example. There's all sorts of examples. You know, every medical intervention, whether it's antibiotics or surgery, carries with it both benefit and risk. And most of the time what we're doing, which is a very natural thing to want to do, is to talk about all the benefits that could occur from it. But we don't do enough to talk about the negative things that might occur.
Is it just an emotional thing for doctors?
You know, it's in part, I think, emotional, and I think both for doctors and for patients, our emotions are very tied up into how we evaluate different risks. And so when things seem, when they touch on a nerve, so to speak, that's when it really affects our decision-making around uncertainty and around risk. But it's also kind of what I talked about earlier was this idea of everyone wants greater certainty, even from a rational perspective. It is rational to want to understand how much uncertainty is around each decision. And so I think it's in part emotional, and I think it's in part rational.
You mentioned Dr. Terry Fried at Yale, who you quoted in your article for the New York Times. He told you that in our enthusiasm for guidelines, we overlook whether treatment is actually in line with a patient's goal. And I've been trying to wrap my brain on the idea of what a patient's goal is for a long time. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So Dr. Fried, she's a geriatrician.
I'm sorry, it's a she.
Yeah, no problem. She's a geriatrician at Yale and the VA there. You know, I think the point that she was trying to make, and I think it's a really important point, is a lot of these guidelines suggest that when someone reaches a certain level of risk, so a good example is statins, for instance, when your risk of a heart attack at 10 years is 7.5%, we suggest starting a statin medication, something like Lipitor or Crestor. And those guidelines, they're generally produced by researchers and policymakers, but they don't have a lot of input from patients on where we should draw the line of risk. And so it's not the case that patients had a great say in whether 7.5% risk or 5.5% risk or 10% risk was one that they would want to accept. And so what we're suggesting here is that we need to do more to use these guidelines in a way that's tailored to individual patients. And so maybe for one patient is the case that they had a relative who had a heart attack in the past, and they're, and it's very important for them to prevent a heart disease, or that they're very concerned about that. And so they would choose to take a statin at a much lower risk, maybe 3% or 5%. It's also the case that some people just hate taking pills, and that it's very inconvenient for their daily life. It's very bothersome. They don't want to be reminded that they have this risk or that they are ill in some way. And so they might be okay with a 10% risk at over 10 years. And so what Dr. Fried is saying, and what I think is important to take away from this, is that the guidelines are important, but the guidelines need to be tailored in a very patient-centered way, and then we can do more to do that as doctors.
Can doctors use more visual aids to help people understand than they do typically?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot more being done in the space of decision aids and risk pictographs. And so these are kind of pictures or schematics that we can work through with our patients. And so it might have 100 different people on the screen, and it'll show you, you know, 10 people are at risk for a heart attack. But if you take this medicine, only 7 of those people will have a heart attack over 10 years, so 3 people didn't. And going through those types of things with patients can be effective. The issue is that those types of decision aids are available for only a certain number of conditions. And so it's not the case that for all the different clinical decisions that doctors and patients are having to make, that you can find these types of decision aids. And that's where it becomes really important to talk very clearly about the uncertainty that is in these decisions, and to probe about what the patient wants, how this treatment might fit into their particular life. There's a great program that I also highlighted in the article. It's called SCOPED, and it comes out of UCSF Medical Center. And SCOPED stands for S-C-O-P-E-D. And the acronym stands for situation. So S is for situation. The first thing is you want to help people understand what's going on. The second is C, so scoped. C is choices. And so what are all the choices? Do you have 2 choices here? Do you have 5 choices? Let's lay out all the choices. Then you go into O. So O is for objectives. And so what are your objectives here? Is your objective to live kind of as long as possible, even if that is the case that you may have a lot of side effects from this treatment? Or is it to have a higher quality of life? Do you want to just reduce your symptoms, even if you trade off something in the process? And then the P is people. And so who is affected? Is it just you that's affected by this decision, or is your family affected? Are your children affected? Is your spouse affected? And then E and D at the end there, Those are evaluating all the choices, and then D is finally making that decision. So that's the way I think we can help people walk through kind of the situation all the way to the decision that they need to make.
And bottom line, how do you feel about people, patients, when they say, well, what would you do?
You know, I think that is a very reasonable question, because often we don't do enough to help and support people through these decisions. And I think the final result often is that question, you know, what would you do, doc? And that's quite all right for a lot of people. I think a lot of people want to kind of put the final decision with their doctors. But I think for a lot of people, that's kind of just an exasperated end to not knowing exactly what to do, not knowing what their options are. And for those people, I really think we can do more to help them understand what's going on.
Dr. Dhruv Kular, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Dhruv Kular is a physician and researcher at Weill Cornell Medicine and director of policy dissemination at the Physicians Foundation Center